This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
In the untouched regions of the forest, the kōkako runs through the treetops feeding on leaves, flowers and fruit. The South Island kōkako, with its distinctive orange wattles at the base of the bill, hasn't been sighted in many years and may be extinct. A situation the blue-wattled bird of the North Island may find itself in unless its habitat is preserved. Its delightful call includes a variety of rich organ and bell-like notes.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good day, friends. Today we have with us Kevin Clements, who is a former director and foundation chair of Peace and Conflict Studies at Otago University, and he's secretary general of the International Peace Research Association. And he's a director of Todo Peace Institute for Global Peace and Policy Research based in Japan. We'll be talking about the gun control. You can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to community or chaos. Kevin, why do you continue to support gun control laws?
Simply because they save lives. They've been shown to be effective in Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom. And countries that don't have good gun control laws have high levels of murder, suicide committed by people with access to and control of guns. So it just seems to me to make perfect sense that we have a good regulatory system that enables us to keep track of where guns are, who possesses them, and in what numbers, and that we also have some mechanisms for ensuring that certain kinds of weapons, those that are most destructive, like automatic assault weapons and so forth, are banned, except for those who have an absolute need for them, which incidentally is mainly the military.
Could you talk about the history of mass shootings in English-speaking countries?
Yes. I mean, if you look at mass shootings over the years, I mean, there were horrific events at Dunblane in the United Kingdom, Port Arthur, Australia, Utøya, Norway, Columbine in Colorado, Virginia Tech, Newtown, Las Vegas, and so forth in America, and most horrifically in terms of mass murder in New Zealand. The 51 people that were killed in the mosque shootings. All of these different incidents precipitated a lot of soul searching about, you know, who was responsible for the guns that were used in these different kinds of massacres.
Where do gun massacres occur most? I understand that anything, if you shoot over four or five people, it's considered mass shooting. Which countries are those?
Well, if you're doing a kind of an international comparison of gun-related killings, as a percentage of all homicides, for example, 80.5% of such killings in the United States are caused by guns. 4% are caused by guns in England and Wales, 11% in Australia, and 40% in Canada. So Canada is still half that of the United States. Those countries really, the U.S. in particular, is leading the field in relation to total numbers.
Australia has quite a low level of gun violence compared to almost any other English-speaking country. Why is this so?
Well, it didn't used to have. I mean, there were numerous occasions of sort of killings of four or five people, and normally related to domestic incidents of one sort or another. But then in Port Arthur, 35 people were killed in cold blood. And that really galvanized the nation and gave John Howard, the then Australian Prime Minister, an opportunity of ensuring that all of the state regulations of guns could come under federal, under one single federal law.
He was not a radical himself. He was a conservative prime minister.
A completely conservative prime minister. And he was very courageous when he was arguing for a change of the gun laws across the whole country. There were many people that issued death threats against him. He had to appear at public meetings wearing armor and so forth to protect himself against anybody taking a pot shot at him. But he eventually prevailed because most people could see that unless they did something about the numbers of guns that were around in the neighborhood or all across Australia, they would very probably just be waiting for another Port Arthur to occur.
They registered every gun in Australia, didn't they? And they also banned automatic weapons.
Yes, automatic assault weapons were banned. And they also insisted on a kind of a new registration process. They made very sure that there were better checks of people who were purchasing guns. And they made sure that, storage facilities and so forth couldn't be opened up by anybody without access, legal access to the weapons.
Apparently, they not only registered gun owners, but they also registered weapons.
Yes, exactly. And that's what New Zealand is trying to do as well with its gun registration program, which is under some threat right now with the current coalition government.
As I understand it, homicide by firearms in Australia went down by 50%, and suicide also went down by 47% since 1997, since the gun control came in.
Yeah.
And they've had only one mass shooting since then, as I understand it.
Yes.
Could you... how do you feel about...
Well, the reason for those figures, Marvin, are kind of rather interesting. When they passed the gun legislation, they had a gun amnesty, and 660,000 guns were returned to the police, and that meant that a large number of guns, which could have been capable of being used in mass atrocities, were then removed from circulation. And I think that and in New Zealand, although we didn't have figures quite as high as that. The gun amnesty that was authorized after our legislation certainly pulled in many thousands of guns.
The United States still has mass shootings regularly. I mean, almost monthly, really.
Yes.
You'll hardly pick up an international paper without some mentioning of a mass shooting in some state in the United States. Some of them are small, just, half a dozen or a dozen. Others are 30 or 40 people. What do you think stops America from having gun control and taking it seriously?
Well, first of all, I think there's kind of a huge populist demand that the Second Amendment be observed. It's becoming almost like a kind of a religious ritual to pay obeisance to that, which is, as most people would claim, most of these proponents of no gun control argue, is a God-given right preserved under the Constitution. That's one reason why. The second reason is that the United States has the National Riflemen's Association, which, although it's been declining in popularity a little bit over the last few years, has been able to wield huge financial power over senators and House of Representatives and members of the House of Representatives. And they've been very active and instrumental in funding political campaigns. And these campaigns and the quid pro quo for NRA funding is that you undertake not to not to promote any gun control and vote against gun control when it's brought before the Senate or before the House of Representatives.
Do they also go after people that support gun control?
Yes, they do. My son used to work at the Brady Gun Control Lobby in Washington, for example, and they had to have very special security because even though that was an organization that came into existence after the shooting of an American senator, because they were committed to high levels of gun control, they had all sorts of death threats leveled against them, so they had very high security in that building. And that's so that when you take a position which is in favor of gun control, you automatically come in the sights of the NRA and other organizations that are in favor of Second Amendment rights. Donald Trump has become a past master at utilizing opposition to Article 2 Amendment, the Second Amendment, in all of his campaigns. And he's played quite a malign influence over the ability of people who are a little more progressive to ensure that they get what they want in terms of legislative outcomes.
The NRA, I understand, not only represents gun owners, but it also represents gun sellers, large corporations that sell guns, and guns is quite a big business in the United States, maybe yes. Second only to military supplies.
Absolutely. And those gun companies do themselves a lot of promotion against gun control lobby.
But they also, I would imagine, influence the NRA and fund the NRA.
Yeah, that's been one of the prime sources of funding for the NRA.
Do they have any clout overseas in other English-speaking countries?
Well, I think it's a little invisible, but there was some rumor, for example, at the last election here in New Zealand, that the NRA was pulling some of the shots because they were many of the arguments that were being made by the ACT representative, who actually, incidentally, comes from an anti-gun control lobby. Many of the things that she was saying sounded like direct quotes from NRA literature.
I like the idea, it's the person who kills, not the gun.
Yes.
But of course, you didn't have the gun, you couldn't kill 30 or 40 people.
No, absolutely not.
The ACT gun control spokesperson considers the fully automatic weapons, such as the AK-47, sporting rifles as a sort of a toy, a game. It's a sport to have a weapon that's fully automatic and it shoots 30 bullets in your magazine. You can change the magazine quite quickly,
yeah.
Which is what happened in the Christchurch mass shooting at the mosque.
Yeah,
he had this fully automatic weapon and he had a number of magazines that he could, so he didn't have to stop. Do you consider a fully automatic weapon as a sporting?
Absolutely not. The only justification for an AK-47 is that it's part of the Army's arsenal. Its primary purpose, and it was developed to ensure that it was a kind of a lethal killer of human beings. It is used, and it was given, and there were some exemptions given in New Zealand in the gun control legislation that was passed. Under Jacinda Ardern, some consideration was given to allowing pest control eradicators access to the weapons because they argued that, you know, they didn't have time to reload and shoot again when they were hunting deer or possums or whatever else they were hunting. So an exception was made for commercial operators, pest control operators who needed such weapons. But there's absolutely no justification whatsoever for such weapons being seen as, you know, playthings or the gun you might want to take to the shooting range. These are just weapons which give people the sense that they're, shooting human targets and loosing off multiple shots. Incidentally, the AK-47 isn't the only weapon that can become sort of automatic in that sense. You put bump stocks on an ordinary rifle, and it begins to feel a little bit like an AK-47. But most of the people advocating for their return, want the real thing in their hands.
Is one of the... do you suspect that people have been influenced by the American attitude toward guns and by the NRA and the fact that a man's only a man if they have a gun?
Well, you know, there's certainly a lot of evidence that suggests that in the U.S. and elsewhere, I mean, owning a gun and carrying it around with you is a sort of an absolute sign of, you know, hyper-masculinity. In Texas, for example, the governor of Texas authorized those who had revolvers to wear them in public and in public places, including bars and places where alcohol was served. So that was sort of like a kind of a throwback to the American Wild West.
Texas is an interesting state. I know back in the 60s, from my reading, that you could actually, if you were a husband and your wife was unfaithful, you had the right to shoot the person who she was being unfaithful with.
Goodness,
this
yeah.
was back in the 60s. I suspect being Texas was still used. But this was back in the 60s.
Yeah, no, Texas is a little anomalous. But even so, it sort of sets the pace in relation to this whole notion of patriarchy and hypermasculinity and the role of guns in relation to, you know, the rejection of the masculine self.
One of the things I do know, I actually am not against all guns. When I was a young person, I grew up in the United States in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And when I was about 11 or 12, I took a course in gun handling and got a license to go hunting with a rifle. I wouldn't say I was a great hunter. And obviously, I didn't kill any human beings. And I gave up hunting after a while. But I understand, you know, some people enjoy hunting, and they actually, then if you have enough pests, there's actually some use for it.
Yeah. Well, if you're looking at rabbits and things like that, you can do that. But even with rabbits, I think the best hunters know that they can shoot them more effectively with sort of weapons that are not AK-47s.
Well, a shotgun's much more useful.
Yeah.
But the things changed in America. I left America in the early 70s. And the time I left, as I say, I've spent a lot of my childhood in the country.
Yeah.
And the ranchers were surrounding me, ranchers and loggers. And during deer season, people would take their rifles out of the closet, load them up, and go hunting. But at the end of the deer season, they would put the rifles back in the closet, lock it up, and the same with the shotguns. And they didn't see the guns. But when I came back in the early 90s for a year-long visit, I saw guns in the back of every ute, and I saw guns in cars, and I saw rifles and shotguns all over the place in open display, like it was an article of fashionable clothing or something. And that's a change in about 40 years, I guess, 30 yeah. years.
Yeah.
America hasn't always been quite as gun happy as it became.
Well, and the arguments you're advancing, I mean, the old frontier and so forth, there were all kinds of animals that spelt fear for people, like coyotes and bears and all sorts of other things. And so at that level, I suppose you could argue that there was some justification for the guns.
Even in the late 20th century and early 21st century, you cull deers. If you don't, it's like you cull deers here.
Yeah.
Otherwise, the trees and everything, the balance gets out of whack.
So
people do go hunting, but they were only used for hunting when I was young, and they weren't put on display.
Yeah.
The thing is that now it's a matter of display. It's a matter of almost fashionable to have a gun.
Yes.
And to carry it.
Well, and actually, contrary to what we've just been talking about in terms of hypermasculinity, a lot of the guns purchased in the United States over the last 5 years have been purchased by women. And so there's been some argument that that women are feeling that in terms of asserting themselves and providing protection for themselves against the patriarchy, they also need to have some of the weapons available to the patriarchy. But the reality is that there are 390 million guns in circulation in the United States. So 120 firearms per 100 residents. So America is awash in guns.
If you have guns in your house unlocked up where people get at them easily, you're much more likely to kill a member of the family or a friend by accident, or you're much more likely to have a suicide by guns.
Yeah.
And these actually happen more often than homicide, which is, certainly they have enough homicide in America, but there's also lots of people die by accident and by suicide because the guns are there and available and they're not safe.
Well, in 2021, for example, there were 26,328 suicides using guns and 20,958 murders using guns. So overall, 48 and 46, nearly 50,000 deaths, avoidable deaths because of access to guns.
So you would like to see, if anything, our gun regulations, you wouldn't like to see them loosened, would you?
No, absolutely not. I think it would be an insult to the 51 people who lost their lives in Christchurch. It would be an insult to all of those who had been arguing for many years before Christchurch that there was a need to do something about New Zealand's gun control regulations. And it would be an absolute insult to the community that's actually benefited from not having such guns.
Well, it would be an insult to the value of human life.
Yes, yes.
I mean, that's the real case for it. Well, I'll play a song now.
Okay.
That was from Mamie and Richard Faremi. Mamie's the sister of Joan Baez.
Oh.
And quite a strong song against violence. We're talking with Kevin Clements, the former director of the Peace and Conflict Studies in Otago, about gun control and the necessity for it and why we should be urging our members of parliament to support gun control and the continuance of gun control as is or stronger. The way to podcast this is by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast and going to Community or Chaos. Kevin, is one of the results of widespread gun ownership, especially of assault weapons in America, been a militarization and heavily arming of police with everything from armored vehicles to assault weapons, with the expectation that they may be attacked or in danger? Could you talk about the results for our police force if we allow automatic weapons to proliferate, for instance?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point, Marvin. There's absolutely no doubt that a lot of the impetus for assault weapons is to kind of match the assault weapons and the firepower available to the police and the military. There's been a, you know,
actually, it's been the other way around, I think, on the police. The police got the automatic weapons because automatic weapons were freely available to criminals in the United States.
Yeah, sure. But I think that there has been a sort of a militarization of policing. And that in a sense has just generated a kind of a negative dynamic on the part of those that feel they might be subject to the law or subject to encounters with the law. I think that in terms of the New Zealand context, despite the fact that we seem to have more and more gun-related violent incidents, it's much better that we continue to retain a specialist armed offenders squad rather than kind of arm the entire police force. So I would be very worried about kind of making sure that absolutely every policeman on the beat had a gun at his or her disposal. I think it's a really important message that, we are an unarmed police because by and large people are law-abiding. And if you move towards hyper-militarization of the police in response to, assault weapons and other sorts of weapons, that will send a very negative signal about our ability to do non-violent policing.
Yes.
And incidentally, the New Zealand Police Association itself has taken a very strong stand on this. They do not wish to have to put up with assault weapons again after the Christchurch shootings.
Well, why would some politicians and political parties wish to follow the American example of lightly regulated or unregulated access to firearms, as in America, instead of the Australian example of well-managed, fully regulated gun arms control?
Well, that's a question you should really ask people in the ACT Party. I think ACT was subject to a very, very systematic campaign by the Registered Gun Owners Association to deregulate gun control, and certainly they were very upset at the notion that you had to be registered, that you have to have good gun control, good checks on your good character checks before you were eligible for a gun. And so I think that to some extent the current move to deregulate is a response on behalf of the ACT Party to quite concerted lobbying. And I think that that's a sort of a sad feature of modern New Zealand politics, in that they see it as progressive to reverse the status quo and to revert to the situation before the Christchurch massacre, when these guns were widely available.
I understand one of the first principles of government, and the reason why we have government from the time of Hobbes and the anarchy you had during the English Revolution, was to protect the citizen from violence, both within the country and from outside violence. Mm-hmm. So would we be going against that principle if we allow uncontrolled access to guns, particularly automatic weapons?
Well, I think it certainly makes it harder to govern in a principled and nonviolent fashion. If there's a deep expansion of the number of weapons available to the police, and more importantly, a widespread acceleration of the number of weapons available to the community. The state rests its power on possessing a monopoly of violence, by which a monopoly of weapons and by having a standing army and all sorts of other things. It sort of seems to me to be very counterintuitive for the state itself to then deregulate access to assault weapons, since these are the very weapons that can kill soldiers and police much more effectively than can ordinary weapons.
Well, a state that doesn't protect its people from violence, including gun violence, are they actually failing in their major contract to the people, to our citizens? We're not just, consumers or happy residents. We're citizens.
Yeah.
We have mutual obligations toward each other.
That's right. And we have a social contract with the state. The social contract is that the state will protect us, will guarantee our welfare and our security, will make sure that things that might cause us harm are diminished, that weapons which cause death and destruction are off the table, and that any weapons that are available are used for the kinds of things that you did as an 11 and 12-year-old. They're used for shooting game and keeping pests down and so forth. And for, you know, getting rid of sick animals, et cetera, et cetera. Those justifications are perfectly acceptable. It's not acceptable, however, to kind of deregulate gun control legislation to make it easier to buy killing weapons that are only really aimed at human beings.
I might play another song, same CDs, but different song.
Okay.
That was Richard and Mimi Framey again. Now I have need of your company, or Children of Darkness. How do you build a more trusting, a more peaceful society? What obligations does the government have to the citizens? And should we be considered citizens anymore?
Well, we're back to the social contract question, which is really important. One of the things about the social contract is that the state should spend in a kind of a welfare system like ours, should spend a lot of time making sure that the human needs of its population are satisfied in relation to education, health, and welfare, and we've got good infrastructure and good institutions behind that. And the better we do that as a government, the less likely that it is that it has to reveal, you know, the iron fist beneath the velvet glove. And, you know, we've been pretty lucky in New Zealand over the years. You know, we've been a largely equal society, egalitarian society. We've had very strong commitment to social welfare and the public good. We're now a much more unequal society, which I think is retrogressive. And governments are unable, because of the fiscal crisis of the state, to do all that needs to be done to ensure that we've got good, effective health, welfare, education systems that mean that nobody gets left behind and that people don't feel marginalized and isolated. So it's a very delicate balancing act. The government can only retain its legitimacy if it serves the public good. When it fails to serve the public good, it has to rely more and more on coercive capacity, the police, the military, surveillance mechanisms, and so forth.
Is this what you think is happening in the United States? Is that why?
I think that's absolutely what's happened in the States. And if you look at what's happened here, the United States installed in our government security communications bureau a kind of a very top secret mechanism for targeted killing called apparition. And that just shows you that, you know, that when a society loses its legitimacy, it has to engage in a lot more extensive surveillance and a lot more harassment of citizens going about their normal business. I think that's certainly what's happened in the States. It's a very polarized community, and the public good is not being served by its political leaders.
What do you think about when politicians and government say, we can't afford health care, we can't afford to spend more on education?
Well, but then they can find money to fly to buy Poseidon aircraft. They can find money to increase our defense capacity. They can find money to kind of provide tax relief to landlords. They can provide resources to, you know.
Would you be willing to pay higher taxes if you could?
I would be absolutely willing to pay higher taxes if our public services could be kind of reformed and were able to deliver the goods that kind of make a make our society a much more gentle and caring place.
Isn't it the problem that we've actually come to believe that taxes are wrong and the market should look after us?
Absolutely. And from Rogernomics.
We're consumers and not citizens.
Yes. And when that happens, we become quite heavily individualized. We become highly competitive. And they're breeding grounds for frustration and aggression. And when you have that kind of frustration and aggression, that's when, you know, the ownership of guns and so forth comes into play. I remember when before the 2016 election, for example, I was in Virginia. And just as you were talking about people.
Virginia
in the United States. And I was really shocked to see some of the slogans on utes and trucks. One of the ones that sticks in my mind was, "We have the guns and we vote." And that's the kind of slogan and the kind of behavior which really means that it becomes very difficult to govern in a nonviolent way.
I'm aware that in the Rust Belt, Pennsylvania, Michigan, these are states where industries were destroyed by free trade and by corporate interest. And not only jobs were destroyed, skills were destroyed for generations. But these people voted twice for Afro-American Obama. And then they switched to Trump because nothing had changed. Mm-hmm. And you had a candidate who was even much more conservative than Obama, Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
So I think you have to be careful when we talk about who votes for people like Trump. When we had the demonstration of the parliamentary grounds against the government, against vaccination mandates, a lot of those people came from provincial areas in New Zealand, small towns, who lost their banks, lost their schools, and ways of earning a living in these towns. Meatworks were shut down, and all done without any real compensation or any attempt to create new jobs or new training or to protect these towns.
Yeah,
and as I'm saying, many of the people who were protesting in the parliamentary grounds came from that area.
Yeah. And Hillary Clinton's one of her biggest mistakes in that election campaign was to call all the people that were supporting Trump deplorables. And they're not deplorable, as you've said. I mean, these are people whose basic human needs for welfare, recognition, and security were not being met. And when they weren't being met by Obama, and it looked as though they were not going to be met by Clinton, people got more and more frustrated, and that frustration then fueled their desire to vote for Trump, who promised to clear the swamp, to get rid of big government and the hidden state, whom he thought was trying to maneuver to undermine his tilted office.
People need respect, and people can feel it if their leaders don't respect them.
Absolutely, yeah.
We assume that people who don't agree with us are dumb. Well, that's not the case.
No, and
I think one of the worst things you can do when you're in politics is call people names. Even calling them racist is not a very necessary, a positive thing or a useful thing to do.
No.
You have to speak to people about who they are and where they're coming from and what are our needs.
And you have to listen.
How much respect do we have for the people we disagree with?
Yeah. Well, that's another kind of fundamental political principle in states which want to be legitimate. And that is that you accord absolute dignity to all of your citizens, irrespective of whether they share your beliefs or not. And the maintenance of dignity is at risk at the moment because we are living in such deeply polarized societies. And communities, and we're becoming more and more tribal in our orientation to each other.
And that's a mistake both the left and the right make.
Absolutely, the left assume that all that the National Party and the coalition are doing is wrong, and vice versa. They assume that the Labour Green coalition got it all wrong.
Also, we assume that we can get inside people's minds and we know what people's attitudes are.
Yes, and we're not listening to each other. We're not creating opportunities for dialogue across these big boundaries of difference. We're not focusing on the politics of inclusion. We're focusing on the politics of fear. And the politics of fear, when accompanied by guns, when accompanied by weapons of both minor and mass destruction, they generate very violent societies and very violent outcomes.
How do you persuade the present government not to loosen gun laws, not to
I think if the proposal to change the gun laws go to select committee, then we need to make sure that the select committees are hearing from all of those who want to maintain the regulations up and down the country. So that's one thing we should be doing. We need to be making sure that we've got all the evidence we need to persuade the ACT Party that moving in this direction would be counterproductive, and we've got good examples to demonstrate that. And we've got Australia, we've got Canada, we've got the UK, we've got Norway, and so forth. There are a large number of countries that have imposed quite strict gun laws after horrific massacres. And so we need to be able to kind of look at those comparative governments and state systems, and say that they've taken the bull by the horns or the guns by the trigger, and they've put in place processes which will enable everybody to feel that they're a part of the political community. One of the biggest challenges facing the world right now is this kind of drift towards autocracy and a drift towards undemocratic politics.
Don't we actually need to work together, both within the country and internationally, to deal with climate change mitigation and the idea of living through climate change, that a government that ignores the fact of climate change and doesn't prepare us is failing to meet its duty to protect its citizens.
Elise Boulding, had this whole notion of a 100-year present, which is that there's somebody alive right now who was born 100 years ago, and we have to really learn from their wisdom, and somebody be born today that will live for 100 years into the future. And we have to make sure that any decisions we make are reversible and don't bind future generations to a life of misery. And because of that, especially in relation to climate change, states have really got to step up to the mark to make sure that our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren have got societies and economies that are sustainable and capable of being lived in. If we don't do that, then the Hobbesian dilemma that you outlined at the very beginning will come to pass. Life will be solitary, nasty, brutish, and short. And we've got to do all in our power. And the welfare state was one of civilization's best efforts at ensuring that the state protected the welfare of its citizens, and to see that being dismantled. I mean, right now, for example, on today's news, there was 160 jobs were about to be axed at the Ministry for Social Welfare. So this is not the right way to kind of earn respect and to ensure that your community is going to be caring and compassionate.
Well, I guess it's a sign of the times when one of the leaders of the coalition says it's all right. We'd like to see 50% of school lunches cut, that the hunger of children in school doesn't matter. It's somehow unnecessary to consider their needs.
Yeah, if basic human needs are unmet, that's a recipe for frustration, and frustration is a prerequisite for aggression. And so it's really critical that we make sure that that all human needs are satisfied, and these just remind everybody again, these are the needs for welfare, for recognition and the maintenance of your own identity, for security, and for well-being.
Well, thanks a lot, Kevin, for coming on board.
My pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you about these issues.
Thank you.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.